Harvest is my favorite tool for tracking time and managing workload, so no one on the team gets overbooked and burnt out. Harvest integrates with so many other project management and bookkeeping tools like Asana, Jira, GitHub, and Xero, so it'll fit right in with whatever your team already uses. You can try it for free at getharvest.com/strongfeelings, and when you upgrade to a paid account, you'll save 50% off your first month. That's getharvest.com/strongfeelings.
I've been deprogrammed. I know who I am.
Hey everyone, I'm Sarah.
And I'm Cattell.
And this is Strong Feelings, a podcast about work, friendship, and feminism, and what happens when you bring them all together. Today, we are going to be talking about beer.
Yeah, our favorite.
We're going to be talking a little bit about beer and what it's like to be a woman in the craft beer industry. Our guest is Melissa Walter, who is the co-founder of Love City Brewing right here in Philly. She's really great. But before we get to that, Cattell, I think we got to check in. It has been a week. How are you doing?
It has been a week. It has felt like an extremely long week for me because we started a coach training last weekend.
Uh-huh, we did.
And I mean, first of all, it was all weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And second, it was just a lot for me personally, you know, a lot of new info, a lot of being outside of my comfort zone in both good and bad ways.
Yes, there was definitely good and bad. We should talk about this.
So learning coaching skills is something I've been thinking about for a while and you and I have talked about. And, you know, I think with a bunch of the things that we're doing together, like collective strength events and teaching workshops, coaching feels like a really obvious skill set to get better at. And after realizing this is something we were both interested in, we started this training program last weekend. And it was just, frankly, a wild experience.
It was. It really, really was. You know, when we had Lara Hogan on the show back in June, she talked about having done a coaching program and how it wasn't the most inclusive environment. And then we went and did the same course. So, like, shame on us.
I mean, you know, sometimes you're like, okay, I've got expectations. I'm going to go see it for myself.
Right. I still was honestly shocked at how little they did to create a safe space in the room for the kinds of vulnerable work we were doing. Like, there was one moment where I really lost my mind. We were all sitting in a circle. There are 28 of us. And they just like picked someone and put them in the hot seat. And they're like, okay, everyone is just going to shout out things that that person is. Just shout out stuff that's like about them. Not based off of anything, not like because you had an experience working with them, just based off your quote unquote intuition and like how they come across by looking at them. And I was like, wait, what? That just sounds like a really huge way to make assumptions and stereotype people. I was so uncomfortable. And of course, the first person that they put into that hot seat was a young woman of color. And people said some wild shit. Like, I couldn't believe some of these things that were coming out of people's mouths. And it was supposed to be productive. It was supposed to be teaching us something. And I still don't really understand what the purpose of that was, except for, like, humiliation.
Yeah, I honestly don't either. And I'm, like, not an expert here, but I think there are likely many other ways of, you know, practicing intuition or, you know, championing other people. I mean, I don't even know if that's what we were doing at that point.
Right. I mean, it was supposed to be telling people positive things like, Cattell, you are kind. Cattell, you are courageous. Which, those might be positive traits or they might be compliments in one sense, but it felt so random. It also felt so uncomfortable to have people just tell you about yourself. Like, I don't feel good about that.
No.
But then I started noticing things that felt suspect, like you are loyal. Like, A, nobody in this room actually knows if that's true or not.
No.
Like,
how could you?
These are all strangers. You can't just tell a random person that you've not talked more than two sentences to that they're loyal. That's weird, right?
Yes.
But then also, so I don't know if it's true. And then also, if you're saying that, let's say, to an Asian American woman, are you basically just falling into stereotypes about like subservience?
Yeah.
And who is that useful to?
Yeah.
And did you ever stop and think about the ways that an exercise like that could be used to reinforce stereotypes or to just project your shit onto somebody else?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I had a knot in my stomach the whole time, just feeling kind of frozen as I watched it all unfold. And I felt like I couldn't even make eye contact with you because I felt like I just couldn't hide my shock and horror.
So funny, because I kept trying to look over at you because I was trying to be like, am I the only one feeling like this? And, you know, we were sitting apart from each other because we didn't want to just keep working with each other. We wanted to make sure we're working with new people. And so I just like was not sure where your brain was during that activity, but I was just aghast. And I actually almost walked out of the room halfway through. I almost was like, I'm not doing this. In my mind, it's like telling people who they are, that to me, that does not feel empowering.
No.
It feels categorizing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to be told who I am. I want to be able to define who I am. Even later on, there was a session where we were doing some practice coaching thing. And one of the assistants from the program, so she's trained as a coach, she was like, Sarah, you're a bold woman. You're a powerful woman. And I'm like, okay, true. Mm-hmm. I am.
Yes.
But no.
Yeah.
I don't want you to tell me who I am. I want to be able to set my own identity. And if you had an interaction with me where you noticed something about me and you were able to like speak to what you noticed me do or say, and then speak to, here's how I perceived you, that to me makes me feel seen.
Sure.
But to just tell me like, Sarah, you are this, no matter what comes after that, like, it doesn't matter what you're saying, good or not good, like, it doesn't feel good to me. It makes me feel just small.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Even if the words are positive, it does not, that doesn't translate to making someone feel good or empowered. I the whole thing was like pretty horrifying. And, you know, after that big group exercise we did all together, where one person was being, you know, picked on, we of course broke up into smaller groups where everyone had the chance to be the subject of this. And I thought I was going to burst into tears during it. And I didn't, like, I, you know, sort of made it through, but there was definitely someone in my group who cried. And you know how I feel about crying. I love to cry, but I just felt like, no, not there. And not because of that bullshit.
Right. Like, there's crying that is healthy and good. Like, letting out emotion is fine.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with crying. There's nothing wrong with her crying in that moment. But it's one thing to kind of go through a transformative experience where you learn something about yourself that brings you to tears, or where you share a moment with somebody else and that brings you to tears. But in this environment, it did not feel like you were processing some deep thing. It just, to me, felt like this like very violating and non-consensual kind of interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not the good kind of tears. It's kind of like the being made fun of on the playground tears.
Yeah, absolutely right. And like I said earlier, like, I think there are many other ways to get to the point I think that exercise was trying to get to. And that was just not the right move.
Gosh, you know, coming out of that, I'm so engaged in coaching methods and like interested in learning more about how to really help people and to learn some different kinds of skill sets, different kinds of listening. I think that's so powerful. And I'm also so disappointed in that particular approach and the way that it just didn't feel like boundaries were really taken into account,
right,
or that like the fact that this is, you know, such an intimate human environment wasn't taken seriously.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I just don't know what to feel.
Yeah. That was tough.
Yeah. Except I do know that I'm tired because it was three yes. very intense days. And then it was like Monday morning again. Hi.
Yeah, like, okay, back to work.
Yeah. I mean, I guess thinking about it, I just think so much about the responsibility that anybody has when they put on an event. Like, when we run a live event for Collective Strength, those are also pretty intimate, vulnerable experiences, or at least they can be. Like, people are talking about difficult subjects. Mm-hmm. And we spend so much time thinking about the space that we're creating together. Like, what is that vibe? How do you make people comfortable? What are the boundaries? You know, like, for example, we never put anybody on the spot and make them say something to the whole group.
Never.
Or like be in the hot seat like that. Like, that is always an opt-in thing. And I also think about things like, what are the expectations of behavior? They're very explicit. The code of conduct is something we talk about every single time. You know, it doesn't mean that it's perfect. I mean, I feel like I learn something new every time we put on an event, and we get feedback here and there about mm-hmm. little things like, oh, have you ever thought about this? Have you thought about that? But we also get a lot of feedback that people notice, that they can tell that we've thought about the details. And some of that is logistical things like the flow of people checking in and getting food and the dietary options.
Right.
But a lot of it is also the creation of that welcoming space, which the logistics play into that. Good logistics will make somebody feel more welcome. And the way that we sort of like have a very open dynamic between us. I mean, like all of these things work together. And people notice that we've thought about those details. And even though it's just a free meetup, we are taking it seriously, that we are really taking responsibility for what we are putting out there and taking responsibility for people's comfort and people's safety. And I think that that really fucking matters. And I just don't think that you should run events if you're not willing to do that.
Yeah, I do too. And, you know, we truly want those things like boundaries and expectations. We want those to exist. So if we're not creating a space that we would want to be in, that would just be fucked. And, you know, B, running these events, that puts us in a position of power, and not considering feedback thoughtfully with care feels reckless.
Yes. Power dynamics. Yes. I think that power dynamics need to be discussed so much more than they are.
Yeah.
You know, I remember at one point over the weekend, we were in the hallway and you referred to the facilitation as irresponsible. And I remember how that just like hit me like a ton of bricks. Yes, it's irresponsible. Because we're in this really intimate environment. I mean, if you can imagine, you know, in this kind of workshop, everybody has to practice coaching, which means they need people to coach. So you end up like talking about yourself and like really intimate stuff in that setting. And so that's a lot to ask people to do. And I think that if you were going to do that responsibly, you need to really be thinking about people's boundaries and thinking about setting expectations and thinking about all of the ways that things might go wrong and making sure that you are sort of like preparing people, reducing harm, all of those different things. And to me, not doing that is incredibly irresponsible, reckless. And of course, if you are then going to come out of that program and become a coach and never think about these things,
right?
That to me seems like doubly reckless. It's like exponentially worse, right? Yes. Because it's like not only what happens in the room, but it's also what are you training people to go do? And if you're training people to go out there in the world and do this thing that is a very intimate relationship with somebody without thinking about any of these pieces that you need in order for it to be safe or good, what kind of coaches are you creating or encouraging?
Right. I mean, that compounds, you know, and it's like I think about myself and it's not a secret. I'm very open and I'm all about being vulnerable, but I have to feel safe to do that. And it takes time and it takes setting expectations. For me, it takes accountability. And I think like this is something that I want to take forward and, you know, kind of take away from that.
Yeah, it reminds me of that episode we did with Priya Parker months and months ago now. If you haven't listened to it, I really recommend it. She has this book called The Art of Gathering, and it's all about how we come together in meetings, workshops, even parties, whatever. But like she talks a lot about the responsibility that we have as people who are organizing or leading in these kinds of environments. And, you know, she talks a lot about this idea of like being chill and like the problem of being chill, like when you're chill in your organization and in your planning that is actually not chill for your attendees.
Yeah.
In order for your attendees to have a chill experience, you should actually be unchill, right? Which I really like.
Yeah, I agree.
So I know I said this episode was going to be about beer, and it is, but also this is 100% what Melissa's interview is about too, because she doesn't just make beer. She also runs Love City's tasting room here in Philly, which is effectively a bar. And in this interview, she talks a ton about things she does to make that space more comfortable and safer for more people, the training that her staff goes through around things like sexual harassment. And that to me was really inspiring because you could just see that she sees this as a big responsibility, that she's not just thinking like, oh, whatever, it's just some beer tasting room, that she's thinking really carefully about her responsibility, risks, and she doesn't want to create a reckless environment, because I think we've all been to that bar.
Yes. And you got to live those values and really bake it in from the start. And I love hearing how Melissa does that.
Melissa Walter is the co-founder of Love City Brewing, a Philly-based brewery founded in 2016. She's also an advocate for getting more women into the beer industry and making the industry more inclusive to everyone. Melissa, welcome to Strong Feelings.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really great.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you right here live with us in the studio.
In Philly. It's just so up the street, exciting. So I figured I should come down in person.
Yeah. So first up, can you tell us a little bit about Love City and how you got started with it?
Yeah, so Love City was a dream of my husband and mine for a long time. We, I think, first talked about it in 2013, and it just took us quite a while to make that dream a reality, but it finally is here. It's open. It's a really great place. So he has the brewing background. He worked at Iron Hill Brewing Company for many, many years, so he kind of knew how to build the brewery from the ground up. My background is completely different. I was a therapist for many years. And had no real business background, but took steps to, you know, educate myself. So I feel like I have some of an idea of what I'm doing now, sort of, but it's been great. Love City is, when we initially conceptualized it, we obviously, good beer is number one. You know, if the product's not there, then what are you even doing? But the rest of it, from my background and my experience, I wanted to make it a very inclusive, welcoming, and warm space. And I'm happy to hear from people now that it does feel that way.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, that you kind of had to get up to speed in the brewing world. What was the learning curve like?
Oh man, I'm still on it. Like, definitely on that hill, not crested it yet. But I love learning stuff. So if it's a challenge, I'm like, okay, great. We're going to figure this out. I'm going to take some classes. It's going to be awesome. It's a new lesson every day. I mean, I'm not a bookkeeper. I'm not a numbers person, but I am now. You know, I learned very quickly how to do that. The Temple Entrepreneurial Series really did help in getting the business plan more fine-tuned and getting that in front of people. So
you weren't always in this business. And before you were doing something completely different. What was the point in time where you and your husband were sort of like, okay, let's do this. Let's open this.
Yeah.
You know?
So his career was kind of taking a different direction with Iron Hill. He would have been on the road a lot and traveling a lot. And he was like, it's not really my thing. And I kind of was having life crises of my own at that time. And I was like, okay, this is feeling like too much for me to try to continue with this work and give of myself to other people when I need it all for me right now. Like, I need to focus on my own mental health. You know, in 2015, I lost both my brother and my father in the space of 9 months.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry.
Thank you. It was a really intense year. And yeah. I just knew at that time, I was like, you know what? This is not good for anybody. It's not good for me. It's not good for the clients that I'm seeing. So I was, thankfully, it just all kind of coincided, because life works that way, like mm-hmm. coincided and worked out that we found some momentum with Love City. Kevin's career was going a different direction. I was feeling really not able to continue with mental health work. And so it all came together to make it happen.
So how did you make it happen? Like, what did you need to do to get it like literally off the ground and, you know, started as a business where you were doing a day-to-day thing?
Lots of money. Breweries are expensive. Honestly, that was our first 3 years, basically, of even having this as a concept was, where are we going to find the money? Where are we going to find the money? So we were able to find a group of actually friends and friends of friends who were behind us and were willing to invest in this company. We also did get a small business loan as well. So that was hugely helpful. And then from that, it was just, okay, now we find a building, which took way longer than it should have. It's all these moving pieces that ironically all kind of have to happen at the same time. So you need money to get a building. Nobody really wants to talk to you until you know where you're going to be. You can't get alcohol licensing until you know where you're going to be. But how do you do that without the money? So it's all just like, it was a mess of Tetris trying to fit everything together. But
yeah, it seems like everything is very interdependent. And
so interdependent.
There's all these moving parts. Like, and it sounds scary at times.
Oh, yeah.
Like, were you ever like overwhelmed or kind of like, what are we doing?
Yes, often, I would say. We put everything on the line, you know, like we had minimal personal funds. We're like, okay, the bank owns our house 3 times, you know, like we have no personal assets anymore because we put it kind of all into this business. So it's really like we have a ton of skin in the game. So it just has to work. And there were so many times. I'm not going to like get into all the construction horror stories, but the one horror story that I will get into is when we had to cut some of the concrete in the floor to put new drains in for the brewery. And it all started falling in. There was a giant sinkhole under our building that we were like, oh, surprise. This is the thing that we have to deal with now. And just things like that. They were like, I was convinced that this is it. Like, this is the thing that like totally ends this and the project is done. But we made it work.
Yeah.
Pulled it out.
Philly sinkhole.
Philly sinkholes everywhere.
That's not super surprising. Philadelphia does have a lot of sinkholes.
Fact.
But the space is lovely. I really like it. So for those who've not been there, who aren't in Philly, it's in this lovely old like warehouse space, right?
Mm-hmm. And yeah. It used to be a manufacturing facility for parts for the railroad, which is super cool. It's like right there.
Yeah. And it feels kind of like warm and bright in there and just very relaxed and not like that overwhelming beer nerd vibe, which it's fine, like get nerdy on mm-hmm. beer, that's great. But there is a point at which breweries have felt to me just too many beer dudes wanting to have beer conversations.
Right.
To the exclusivity of everything else.
100% agree. Yeah.
How did you make a space that wasn't like that?
I mean, the physical space is important, I think, first of all. Like you mentioned the building, and it is this big old, you know, railroad type building and big high ceilings. And so the infrastructure is really beautiful. But obviously we did have to do a lot to sort of modify and make it ready for the public. So one of the things that we always kept in mind in construction was, how are we going to make this space accessible to everybody? So like our front entrance is a ramp. Like everybody comes in the same way, you go up the ramp, done. So people who use a chair or don't use a chair, same entrance, same accessibility as everybody else. All of our bathrooms are gender neutral, so anybody can use any bathroom whatsoever, you know, wheelchair accessible stalls, that kind of thing. So building that in, you know, from day one was important in construction. And as far as like the vibe, it's kind of a weird alchemy. Honestly, I think my background helps a lot in that because I'm not a beer nerd. Like I enjoy good beer. I also will drink a Bud Light when I'm at a picnic. You know, God, the beer world is probably cringing right now, but
we're not in
it happens, okay? Brewers still drink Bud Light. You know, so I'm not industry insider, so certain things that I probably don't even notice because it's just like my general daily life that I'm like, okay, well, you know, we don't have to do it this way. I think having other options for people is huge. You know, obviously our beer is number one and we're really proud of what we make. If you're not into beer or if you're gluten intolerant, we do have options for you. You know, we do carry Pennsylvania-made wines and liquors as well. So it feels like a space that anybody can come to, whether or not you're a super beer nerd or not.
So I also wanted to ask a little bit more about working with your husband, because mm-hmm. I think some people work great with their partners. Some people should not work with their partners. How do you make it work?
Oh, it's a never-ending conversation. I feel like just now we're starting to kind of get into our vibes and our routines, and we've been open for 18 months. So it's a long process of figuring out who's doing what and when and how. And like, we are very collaborative, you know, like we kind of have our rules, but it's not like a hard and fast barrier. You know, like if he's doing something in the brewery, you know, he will ask my opinion, like, oh, do you think this type of beer would do well? And I believe he really does respect that, even though I'm not like the brewer, quote unquote. And same goes for me. You know, I'm kind of like HR, marketing, tap room, finance, and everything else. And so when he needs something, he can come to me and be like, okay, well, I need to spend X on Y. You know, what do you think? We've always been good at communicating. So I think that's just the key for anything.
Yeah, it seems like a whole lot of other division of labor. Like you already have to do that in a partnership and then you can do that again for work.
Oh, man. Yeah. And the home division of labor we're working on too. also a never ending conversation.
Yeah, ongoing topic for sure. So something I've seen lots of times when it comes to kind of like particularly husband-wife businesses and particularly maybe in sort of like restaurants, hospitality, I'll often see the kind of like husband role being very public-facing, almost taking like that like star role, and then the wife role sort of being more like behind the scenes, doing all the books and the HR, which you said you're mm-hmm. doing.
Yeah.
But you've been really visible in the company. I know that you've been really involved in kind of not just the marketing of the company, but sort of like talking about things you want to see happen in the industry. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about women in beer, for example. And I'm curious if you ever felt pressure to be more in the background, or like, do people tend to go to him first? Do you experience anything like that?
So this is me being out of my comfort zone. I love, you know, talking one-on-one. I'm great, you know, individually. When it comes to groups, crowds, like big stuff, I'm always kind of like, no, I'm good. I'll just hang out in the background. But owning this business has definitely forced me out of that zone. And it's just, it's stuff that I am passionate about and that I want to see happen. So I feel like I have to be out there. You know, if this is my goal and if this is what I truly want to see change in the world, then I just kind of have to. Discomfort or not, you know, you just kind of like get out there and work through it. The like people coming to him first. I've seen it. You know, it happens less now, I think, than it did initially. So that's good. I mean, I will say 99% of our people were awesome, but there were a handful that we worked with in construction and in banking and all that stuff that was just kind of like, ugh, really? Like, okay, you know I'm handling all the books over here, right? You know that's me.
There's nothing like a conversation with somebody who goes like, well, why don't you talk that over with your husband and let me know? And I'm like, bitch, I can make the decision right here.
Exactly.
Thankfully, I've never heard that. But it's just like, oh, that subtle crap is just, oh, it's terrible.
Yeah, it infiltrates everything.
It does. It's terrible.
So something, you know, we're touching on a little bit is being a woman in beer, where it's very male dominated. Can you tell us a little bit more about the industry and your experience there? Mm-hmm.
I wish I had data. You know, I wish I had data on the industry, but unfortunately we don't yet. There was just actually a study that came out talking about like the racial and somewhat gender diversity in the brewing industry, but it was mostly focused on race. But so how many women brewers are there? Like, we don't know. You know, how many women-owned companies are there? Like, we're not really sure. So it's hard to say. I personally think it's getting somewhat better. You know, I think that there are plenty of visible women out there in the industry. Thankfully, there's the Pink Boots Society, which contributes money towards educating women in the industry and just kind of a community of support and whatnot. But obviously, we all know it's still very male dominated. I mean, from my experience in Philly, it's been pretty good, actually. Like, there are not many women in the actual physical brewing jobs in Philly, but there's plenty of women in the industry. There's a lot of resources out there and people to connect with. So that's been good.
When you were getting started, you know, did you ever feel like it was difficult to kind of feel like you were being taken seriously?
Yeah. I mean, I think that also came from my very different experience, you know, coming in as a therapist and not really having any beer background professionally whatsoever. It was a little bit like, is this because I just don't really know beer yet? Or is this because like they think I don't know anything because I'm a woman? Or what is this about? Yeah, it was hard to tease that out.
You put on an event earlier this year, a festival called Bold Women and Beer. Can you tell us about what that was and why it was important to you to put that on?
Yeah, it was so much fun. We're already planning for May 2020, so get ready. It was the first women-focused beer festival in the state of Pennsylvania. There have been others around the country, but this was the first that we know of in the entire state, so we're super excited about that. There are women in the industry, we just have to find them and sort of bring them together. So we started with members of the Pink Boots Society. So anybody that makes any a portion of their income via beer can join the Pink Boots Society. And then we had that list of membership to kind of pull from and say, hey, like, do you have anyone who'd be interested in coming out to this festival and pouring beer and showing off what they do for a living? So we really wanted to bring all the women together and showcase all the women that are in the industry already.
That's awesome. We should mark our calendars for that.
I would definitely go to that.
And we got really good bands and we're already working on this year. So we want to make it more, we definitely are making it bigger this year. We're trying to close down the streets. So have Buttonwood and Hamilton Street closed, make it bigger, invite more breweries, invite vendors, more bands. So
something I love about Philly is the commitment to the block party.
Oh my God.
The block party. So it's true. A real thing.
It is fabulous.
So you mentioned that there's a recent report that came out on racial diversity. Mm-hmm. So there's more data on that than on gender. What does it look like from a racial perspective? I have some guesses.
Not good. Yeah. The answer is not good. Yeah, I don't have the like actual numbers, but I know in general, front of house is okay in terms of racial diversity. So the people that are actually serving, that are pouring the beers, that are serving the food is okay. Breweries, like actual physical making the beer, canning the beer, that kind of thing is pretty abysmal. Ownership is maybe a little better than the actual brewery, but it's still pretty bad in terms of racial diversity.
Yeah, it just seems like an industry that because it's had so much growth and so much interest in mm-hmm. the last, I don't know, 2 decades or something, right? That it just seems primed to also really deal with maybe some of its
history. Oh, it's been time.
It's been
more than time to deal with this kind of stuff. I mean, thankfully, there are now more resources. So like the Brewers Association, which is the national trade organization, does have a diversity ambassador and a diversity committee. So the state of Pennsylvania, we have the Brewers of Pennsylvania, which is our state guild. And I'm actually on the diversity and inclusion committee for that. So we're looking at ways to sort of, you know, make it look like the rest of the state. You know, I think any industry should look like the community in which it's involved.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of community and kind of going back to the groups that you're involved with, why is it important to you to be part of those communities and to build them up? Like, what have you gotten out of it?
People ask me, like, why are you doing this work? And I'm like, I have to. Like, it's hard to articulate because it just seems like the thing that everybody should be doing. And, you know, unfortunately, I recognize that it's not. But it's obviously been a part of my life for a long time. So I got into therapy with a very sort of strong social justice, like, idea. Like, I'm going to help people and it's going to be great. So I'm never going to let that go. Like, that's just part of my personality and who I am. So being in this industry, I'm not leaving that part of my personality out. Like, it has to come with me and I have to do something with it.
Yeah, I like that idea that it's just always there. I relate to that. It's like, no matter where I am, I'm always thinking about
this.
Right.
Like, if you were working at, I don't know, wherever tomorrow, you would probably still be the same person. And yeah.
Absolutely. And so I want to get into some of the other stuff that I think has made Love City unique, or at least special to me. One of them is, I was reading an article about how this summer you had your staff trained through something called Safe Bars Philly. And I would love if you could tell everybody what Safe Bars Philly is and why that was part of your curriculum.
So Safe Bars Philly is a program that does trainings for bars and restaurants on how to recognize and intervene in sexual harassment. So Philadelphia's Center Against Sexual Violence is the one that puts on these trainings here in the city. And I think it's hugely valuable. Obviously, when you add the element of alcohol to anything, it sort of kicks everything up a notch. So, you know, knowing you're in a bar, you know, there's lots of alcohol around. These are behaviors that happen in the world in general, but now you're here in this, you know, tight environment with booze. So, like, risky, you know? So it just made so much sense to me that if we can take advantage of this, like, we absolutely should.
How common is it when you're talking to your peers in the industry, or when you're talking with other people who work in bars and restaurants? Like, how common is this kind of training? Is this something that people are really implementing often, or are you a little bit more on the leading side of that?
Unfortunately, there are not. I think there are 5 bars in the entire city of Philadelphia that have gone through this training, which is super disappointing to me. I mean, it's not that bad. Like, it's 2 hours, one day. It's not that expensive. Like, there's really no reason, I think, for people to not take advantage of this. So things that I've read from other places are that if they do take advantage of this training, it's like they're admitting something's wrong. And I'm like, no, like, you're doing the thing to make sure things don't go wrong.
And, like, something is wrong. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, something's wrong.
Yeah.
Like, we have a problem of sexual harassment and sexual violence in this world and in this city. Like, the idea that somehow your bar is special and, like, that would never happen here. I mean,
yeah. You're a completely harassing the environment.
Well, and as you said, it exists and it happens in the world. Like, it's everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was helpful on 2 levels. One, on the sort of just skills level. So learning, like, it's just great for, like, life training. Like, I feel like I, as a human being, as an individual now, can go out into the world and be like, oh, I have tools. Like, I have things that I can do if I see something weird happening. So they talked a lot about, like, deflecting or distracting the person if there's something happening and it seems a little weird, just kind of, like, walking up and being like, hey, how's it going? How's your night? Can I get you some water? You know, just things like that. For people that are more direct, you know, you can be more direct with people. Or just, like, delegating to another person if you don't feel comfortable, you know, jumping into that scenario. So, like, 3 skills, easy to keep in mind. I mean, difficult to implement, easy to keep in mind. So just at the skills level, it was hugely valuable. But I will say, possibly more valuable, was having the staff hear each other's stories. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, a pretty diverse staff. We've got men, women, you know, younger, older, and listening to 99% of the women talk about their experiences in the world and in the restaurant industry, and then looking at the guys' faces and then being like, oh my God, like, this is bad. Like, this happens and it's bad. And these are people that they've worked with for over a year. They're pretty comfortable with each other. They trust each other. So I think that was huge.
It's always interesting to me when it's sort of like you can see it dawn on some guy's face. Mm-hmm. Wait. Really? It's really that bad? Mm. Where have you been? Yeah. So you've done this training, and obviously you have this background in therapy. This is something that's important to you to make, you know, the space, like you said, inclusive, which means safe. Are there other things that you're keeping in mind beyond training the staff that are intended to help make sure that the people who are coming to Love City to have a good time actually have a good time?
I think it's a combination of obviously the space itself and being inclusive and being set up in a way that's conducive to that. I think it's hiring the right people that are warm and welcoming and not going to, you know, talk down to people or just make them feel uncomfortable in any way. I think it's the types of events that we have, you know, just being very conscious of how things come across. And like, yeah, anybody can rent our space, but if we're putting our name anywhere near it, like it better be better be right.
So something else I noticed about Love City is that you do this quarterly giving program, and that seems like something that's pretty important to you. So I'm curious if you can tell us about that. When and how did it start, and why is that part of the way Love City works?
I mean, that was me. I was like, this has to happen. It just has to be a part of what we do. Because, you know, coming from the background that I come from, it's like I know how much need there is in Philadelphia. And we do try to keep it pretty local. I mean, I know there are nationally and regionally, there are huge things to be dealt with as well. But we're in Philly. We want to give back to Philly. So I kind of baked it into the business plan from day one, which is also hugely helpful because it lets people know, you know, what to expect. Like, so our investors are all on the same page because it's like, hey, look, this is baked in here and this is what we're going to do every single year that we are in existence because it's important to us. So the first year we actually asked our social media fans and followers to help us choose those organizations. So they nominated people and then voted. And then we sort of got it from the sort of collective that was around us. For 2019, we asked our staff to nominate organizations and we voted on them. I think we're actually going to tweak it a little bit for 2020. I heard a lot that people wanted to engage more with the nonprofit. So I think we're going to go down to 2, but sort of engage on a deeper level. So, I mean, quarterly sounds like 3 months is a long time, but it's really not a long time at all. So to give ourselves 6 months to be able to say, okay, for 6 months, we're donating 10% of all the sales of this particular beer back to you. And also, we would like to do things like volunteer with your organization or host events in our space for you or things like that. So,
right. Yeah, I think one of the things I've definitely seen with nonprofits is that sometimes people come in and they want to help, but without that deeper understanding of the organization, without a deeper commitment to the organization, they can't really help in it, or, you know, like they can't really do anything for them. So 6 months makes sense.
Yeah, I was kind of feeling that way about this year. I mean, this year we did have some awesome organizations because they were super close to our staff's hearts. So they were already kind of involved in those things. So, but I was already feeling like, well, like, how are we going to engage in a way that feels like not transactional, you know, in a way that's sort of more like relationship building and engaging and things like that. So I think that's where we're headed.
Now, you mentioned that this is something that you baked in from the very beginning, and I'd love to ask about that because I think a lot of businesses kind of have it in their head that like, yeah, that would be great once this happens or that happens, once we hit this certain size, once we reach a certain level of profit margin, et cetera, then we're going to think about that. And you said that kind of baking it in from day one was, in fact, easier in some ways. So I'm curious about like, how did you make that choice? What did your investors say about it?
I think not coming from a business background was actually really helpful in this sense because I mean, yes, of course, we need to make money. We need to keep the doors open. We need to keep the lights on. But beyond that, I'm like, well, why do you need $5 million this year? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying that making money is terrible, but I'm saying like you can build these things in, grow a little more slowly, be a little more conscious about the other things you take on, and you're also already doing something that's hugely beneficial to the place where you're deriving benefit from. You know what I mean? Like, you live in this place, you should take care of it. It's like sweeping up your block or something,
right?
Which is a terrible analogy, but like,
some people don't do that either.
No.
And you know, you also mentioned, so it's 10% of the sales of one particular beer at a time. And is that enough? Like, are you really noticing that in the bottom line? Like, do you feel like, because I know food and beverage industry doesn't always have the biggest margins. And is this something where it's like you kind of have to feel it a little to make it make an impact?
Would it be great to have an extra 10% in revenue? Like, sure. But like, it's not that much of a hit that we can't do all of the other things that we already want to do, you know? So it's more important to me to be, you know, doing this give back constantly than to have a little bit of extra money.
Like, yeah. Yeah. It just seems like the mentality shift is so valuable by thinking about it from the beginning. Mm-hmm. You're like, I don't know. We never spent the money.
Yeah. It's not even there. Who cares? Yeah. It's just over here in this other pile. And the same thing goes for me with like, I always get so annoyed with the industry about hearing about like benefits for your employees. Like, oh, well, when we get a little bigger, we can offer benefits. Like, no. I care about my employees. I care about my staff. They're getting their benefits now. Like, it's not about 3 years from now. And it's just silly to me that you don't factor those things in when you build your models out. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, we could get into a long conversation about the erosion of employee benefits and the instability of the labor market. But it's always nice to see businesses realizing, like, you can have both of those things. Yeah. You just have to actually have a plan that supports it.
Exactly. Yeah. You can do anything. Anything is a choice. You can just make the choice to do it and then figure out how to make it work, which is, I mean, and we did it from the beginning, which I grant you is easier because it's already sort of baked in, but you can choose to do it tomorrow if you really want to.
I like hearing a lot of that just because I think people don't often think about the sort of slow and intentional approach as being, you know, maybe a higher payoff in the end. So, yeah.
No, I think it really definitely awesome. Is.
So we're almost out of time here, but before we go, we wanted to ask for a little bit of advice.
Oh, no.
So first up, you know, for listeners who are working in a male-dominated field, what can they do to start creating community for women and other genders, you know, who might need that?
You know, I'm sure even in the most male-dominated industry, there are women somewhere. You know, find them and talk to them and hopefully be friends with them and start your community there. That's a self-care thing. That's also a resources thing. That's just, I think, where you got to start because one person can't do it alone.
How did you first start, like, connecting with and finding other women in the industry? Like, how did you build those initial relationships?
Honestly, having the Pink Boot Society was hugely helpful. I basically had a list of people to kind of reach out to and choose from. It's even people that, like, you just come across, like, bar owners, for example, that are like, oh, I know so-and-so from this brewery, and oh, yeah, you should talk to her. And so it's just kind of mining the network that's there. It's a lot of work, but, I mean, I think it's worth it.
It is work to kind of put yourself out there in that way and kind of always be doing the networking thing.
Oh,
but
if it's networking, I'm like, do I have to?
but having community is so valuable. Yeah. Okay, so second advice question. You have done a lot of work to keep Love City kind of connected to your core values, your core beliefs. There's a lot of that we've talked about baked in from the beginning. What advice would you give to someone who is kind of struggling there in terms of like aligning what they do on a day-to-day basis? They go to work at some company with their own values.
When it's not your thing, it's harder. You do have to walk a line between what your company needs and wants and what you need and want. But I think there's always little ways to do stuff like that, whether it's, I don't know, tearing down the gendered bathroom signs and just putting up new ones or asking if you can do that, you know, just being that person that can kind of take ownership over some of those things. Again, not trying to save the world and like do everything for everybody, but if it's a value of yours that's important, there's got to be at least a small way that you could sort of finagle that into your position.
Make other people just a little uncomfortable.
Yeah. They're uncomfortable. That's not your fault.
Yeah, start there. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for joining us today. For our listeners in Philly, you can check out Love City in person at 10th and Hamilton in Cal Hill. But for everyone else, how can they learn more about Love City and about you?
LoveCityBrewing.com is our website. We're on all social platforms at Love City Brewing. My personal Instagram is at Love City Melissa. That's us.
Awesome.
And you'll find me in Cattell at Love City having a beer.
That's
I
right.
Very
so,
soon.
Yes.
We have happy hours, so hopefully we'll see you there.
We'll be there.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. This has been great. Thanks.
Okay, Cattell. It's that time again. Are you ready with a fuck yeah?
I am. So remember earlier we talked about crying and not always the good kind?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to give a fuck yeah to the good kind of crying because I just did it very recently and I did it openly and fully and I did it in front of you.
Can I just say that you did it literally in this recording studio?
I did just moments
15
ago.
Minutes ago.
And at the end, it was like a big sigh of relief and I did it in front of a friend. I like fuck yeah to that as well because you actually held space for it and you said it's okay, not what it, you know what's wrong, and that went a long way.
It is okay.
Yeah,
needed some time.
Yeah,
yeah,
it did.
Yeah, yeah, fuck yeah to that. I think it's okay to cry and it's okay to take up that space to do it. And something I actually want to work on getting better at is being able to hold that space and let people kind of sit with their feelings, which is important to me.
Yeah, I feel like I'm hearing some more stories of people just kind of like crying in public and I'm all about it.
Ugh, yes. I don't know if you remember, a week or two ago now, there was this like clip of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez going around crying about climate change. Like she was moved to tears about climate change.
Yeah.
And there was this whole thread on Twitter about how like, oh, this just shows, you know, like why there is a stereotype that women are too emotional for politics because they cry at things like this. And I'm like, what are we talking about?
why can't she? First off, she's allowed to cry. And yes. I think it actually shows a lot of strength to be able to push for the things she believes in so clearly and so consistently and also open up emotionally. That actually takes a lot.
Yes.
But also fucking climate change. Climate change is like going to upend the lives of millions of people. It already yes. is starting to do that. People's yes. lives are threatened. Like, we should all be heartbroken over that.
I could not agree more. I mean, I have cried recently about climate change.
Yes. It is like yes, because it's terrifying.
Right.
And, you know, I think that pretending that it isn't doesn't do anybody any good. I think that's actually one of the big problems yes. in government and in business is sort of like this idea that everybody can be cool and detached about stuff that why should we be cool and detached about? It is actually like real human cost.
Yes.
And not being able to access that feeling and that pain and not tapping into the reality, I think it sort of keeps things at a distance. And so we don't actually think about like how important they are because we keep them at the like policy level.
Yeah. And if you think about it, if you don't go through that and you don't process it, you don't let that crying happen and feel the like relief and the catharsis after it, like maybe you can actually move, you know, towards a solution or like move towards something better.
It is so much easier, I think, to move forward once you've allowed yourself to really feel what you feel.
Yeah.
And, you know, we didn't call this strong feelings on accident. It's something we really believe in.
It really is. So
fuck yeah to crying.
Yeah. Fuck yeah to crying. Well, that's it for us this week. Strong Feelings is recorded in Philadelphia and produced by Seth Colburn at Edit Audio. Our theme music is Deprogrammed by Blow Dryer. They are an awesome Philly-based band that you should check out at blowdryer.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Melissa Walter for being our guest today, and thank you for listening. If you liked our show today, don't forget to subscribe and rate us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Also, don't forget to get some Strong Feelings delivered right to your inbox. Sign up for our newsletter at strongfeelings.co. See you again next week.
Bye. I've been deprogrammed.